You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 22nd of June 2017 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily in association with UBS. Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to the Monocle Daily here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Coming up in tonight's programme, US Republican senators unveil another proposed replacement for Obamacare. But will it actually pass? And what will it mean for American healthcare if it does? Also ahead, was Islamic State's demolition of the Great Mosque of Al-Nuri their way of admitting that the battle for Mosul is almost over? A bit later on, we'll meet two entrepreneurs in Shanghai and Beijing who are breathing new life into Chinese cuisine.
A lot of the old school establishments are either shut down or they've changed hands and they're no longer run by people who have been doing it for decades.
We'll look at the ethical entanglement which has cost a distinguished foreign correspondent his job, and we'll discuss the student-led campaign to desegregate schools in Bosnia-Herzegovina. That's all coming up in the next 60 minutes on the Monocle Daily, live from London on Monocle 24. But first, a quick look at the day's other top stories. US President Donald Trump, who previously threatened or at the very least implied that he possessed recordings of his conversations with former FBI Director James Comey, has now denied making or owning any such recordings, almost as if he is prone to making empty promises he has neither the inclination nor the capacity to deliver on. The House Intelligence Committee investigating collusion between Trump's presidential campaign and Russia had previously asked for the tapes to be handed over. Theresa May, still more or less Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, has arrived in Brussels to brief EU leaders on the UK plans for protecting the rights of EU citizens living in the UK after Brexit, assuming, of course, that any of them still want to stay here. May, whose recent attempt to shore up her mandate resulted in the removal of her majority, also seems likely to be bombarded with semi-mocking suggestions that she call the whole thing off. The Prime Ministers of Ireland, the Netherlands and European Council President Donald Tusk have reiterated that the UK is welcome to change its mind. Israeli airline El Al has been told to cease its practice of asking female passengers to switch seats if an ultra-Orthodox man objects to having to sit next to one. Jerusalem Magistrates Court was responding to a suit brought by a female passenger who had been asked to switch seats on a flight from Newark to Tel Aviv. The judges ruled that such requests break Israel's anti-discrimination laws. There have been several cases of flights being delayed by ultra-Orthodox men refusing to take their seats in such circumstances. And an American man who opened fire in a Washington, D.C. pizzeria after believing something he read on the internet has been sentenced to 4 years in prison. Edgar Madison Welch was among the bewilderingly hefty cohort of Americans entranced by the conspiracy theory which held that members of Hillary Clinton's circle were operating a pedophile ring from the premises of Comet Ping Pong Pizza. Nobody was injured when Mr. Welch shot at a door. It is believed that rocket science will struggle on somehow during his detention. Welcome to tonight's Monocle Daily with me, Andrew Muller. It was, along with the Mexico border wall he still hasn't quite gotten around to starting work on, the signature promise of Donald Trump's campaign for president. The repeal of the Affordable Care Act, colloquially known as Obamacare, and its replacement with, Americans were assured, something terrific. We've learned something today about Trump's definition of terrific with the unveiling of a healthcare plan by Republican senators. Well, joining us now with more on this is Washington correspondent Sasha Eisenberg. Sasha, to go back to where we came in, what was Trump's actual objection to Obamacare beyond it being called Obamacare?
It was so scattershot that it didn't really amount to a sensible policy critique. He promised that he was going to make sure everybody was covered, that they were going to pay less and have better care, and generally that it was going to be terrific. These are things that no healthcare, put aside the claim of terrific, these are things that no healthcare economists say you can do all at once. And so it was never really clear what the objective of the White House, the House Republicans or now Senate Republicans was other than to fulfill this sort of 7-year rolling promise, mostly to the conservative parts of their coalition, that they were going to do something that qualified as repeal and replace of Obamacare, which has grown more popular now. So now they are basically tilting at one of the more popular public policy institutions in American life. And it's not exactly clear what replacement would be to any of them optimal.
This Senate bill, then, how does it differ from the previous one floated by House Republicans, which even Donald Trump described as mean?
There's not a kind of coherent through line about the ways in which it is different. It, you know, Mitch McConnell did this in secret. He has to get 50 votes for it. He has 52 Republicans. If they get to 50 votes, then Mike Pence will break the tiebreaker. And it very much seems like it was cobbled together to balance ambivalence on both sides of his caucus. There are a handful of Republicans on the right, notably Rand Paul, Ted Cruz, who have been critical about the House Republican plan for basically being too generous, keeping too much of the sort of traditional Medicaid-centric public safety net intact. Another group of conservative Republicans who want to see this used as a vehicle to get rid of funding for Planned Parenthood. And then on the sort of, you know, left end of his conference in the Senate, there are some moderate Republicans, including a couple of women, who are offended by the cuts of Planned Parenthood and are also concerned in some states, including Ohio's Rob Portman, that the Medicaid cuts would be devastating to their states. And so, McConnell seems to have done is given just enough to each group that he can keep them engaged in negotiations for at least another week when this comes to the floor and they can offer amendments. But McConnell's not declared what his objective is other than, you know, I think ideally to see this pass, but at the very least to get it to a vote so he can be done with it. This is a huge impediment, both in terms of the calendar and the politics of it. And I think McConnell would like to see it out of his life by the July 4th holiday recess, above all.
Should we, and should Republican senators more to the point, be braced for the fact that Trump is going to be even more antsy about this because he knows that it will become colloquially known as Trump care?
Yes, and we saw it today already at the White House briefing. Sarah Huckabee Sanders, when asked about this plan that his colleagues on the Hill, members of his own party, had unveiled just an hour or two earlier, she said he's not necessarily supporting it. The comments about mean, the other things he's been saying recently is he thinks that the plan should have more heart, which last night at a rally in Iowa he directly equated with spending more money, which is pretty much as antithetical to the modern Republican worldview as you could put it. Yeah, I think that we have seen consistently Trump slag proposals, initiatives taken by other Republicans at the moment that they seem unpopular, and I think that Republicans have already braced themselves for the idea that the best they can hope is that if they get something off of Capitol Hill eventually, when it becomes a binary choice between signing it or not signing it, he'll sign whatever they give him, but that he will not be a useful partner just in terms of even PR for making the case for whatever they're trying to get passed.
Sasha Eisenberg, thank you. For more on what the bill might actually mean if it does become law, I'm joined now by Matthew Weinstock, Managing Editor of Modern Healthcare. Matthew, for an international listenership especially, can you boil down at all what the main differences would be between what exists now, the Affordable Care Act, and what is being proposed by the Republican senators?
Sure, certainly, and thanks for having me on your program. I think Sasha sort of captured some of this in terms of the expanded coverage, really for healthcare providers in the U.S. One of the biggest things that the Affordable Care Act did was expand coverage to millions of Americans who, up until then, did not have coverage, whether that was through the Medicaid program, which is a partnership between the federal government and states, and is intended to extend coverage to low-income people. And the program, the ACA, also made it a little more affordable for people, or intended to make it affordable for people to buy coverage on the individual insurance markets. Sort of where the Republican bills seem to be going is to curtail some of that expansion. And so that creates some consternation among our core readers, who are healthcare executives, be it in the provider space or elsewhere.
From the point of view of somebody who, I know it's very hard to come up with an idea for a generic customer of the Affordable Care Act, but say you know it is somebody who is, you know, on a reasonable sort of middle class wage, has a family, etc., etc. Does the new act as we understand it, or the new bill as we understand it, is there anything it would make better for the average Affordable Care Act claimant?
That's hard to say, because it, you know, if you look at it from a Medicaid perspective, it would make it worse, because those people who gained coverage under Medicaid expansion in 31 states that expanded Medicaid, most of those states would probably curtail their Medicaid expansion once the funding were to run out. So in the Senate bill, that funding would run out in 2023, and those states would be hard-pressed to be able to match that money that they would be losing from the federal government, which means that those people who gained coverage would not be able to get back into Medicaid. So for those people, it would be very, very tough. For those who gain coverage in the individual market, that remains to be seen. The subsidies probably would not be as generous as they were under the Affordable Care Act.
If this bill was a sincere attempt to improve healthcare coverage, obviously no system is perfect, and I'm sure Obamacare isn't, but what particular weaknesses does it have as is that could have been addressed?
The Affordable Care Act?
Yeah.
So I think if you talk to people across the country, the Affordable Care Act was not perfect in their eyes, and that goes to provider groups, physicians, and hospitals who ultimately supported the Affordable Care Act because it increased coverage, it increased insurance, but they also saw flaws in it. And one of the challenges we've had is on the individual market, where costs have gone up, premiums and deductibles have gone up over periods of time since the Affordable Care Act came into existence. And part of the problem was that they didn't have as many young, healthy people, if you will, signing up for coverage as they thought. So we had more sick and high-risk patients signing up for coverage, which drove up costs for insurers. And that transpired to higher costs down the line. So I think that's one of the things you heard on the campaign trail was these high-cost, high-premiums that patients and consumers were experiencing. And that's one of the things that the Republicans and Donald Trump were elected to try to address.
Just finally then, I'm sure it's a question you've heard variations on many times from people who are not Americans and therefore really don't understand how America keeps having this argument with itself. But is there any sense that you perceive that the wrangling over healthcare is igniting any popular will at all to move America towards something what like almost every other developed nation in the world has, i.e. a state-funded, single-payer healthcare system?
That's a really good question. I don't know that we have that political will exists in this country. In California, for instance, there has been legislation moving through California this year, in fact, to make California a single-payer state. But the costs of that program would be so exorbitant that it's unlikely to gain much traction to move through and get to the governor's desk. So to try to do that on a national level, I think, would be very hard, given sort of the entrenchment of various groups within the United States.
Matthew Weinstock, Managing Editor of Modern Healthcare, thanks for joining us. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
No one has more. No one knows more.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com. Summer is officially here, and so is Monocle's bumper July-August double issue. Here we celebrate quality of life and reveal this year's rundown of the top 25 cities to live in worldwide. We also meet the people striving to make life in their cities better, from the mayor of Los Angeles to the sunny team that looks after Tokyo's parks and gardens, to the urban heroes giving back to their hometowns. Meanwhile, in design, we cast our gaze up to the rooftops in Milan and find a hidden and surprisingly verdant world above the fray. And of course, we've always got room for a bit of pure hedonism as we dance the night away in Tel Aviv, unwind in Finland's most inviting and steamiest company retreats, and tuck into some sun-kissed beach food in Valencia. And speaking of sun-kissed, we also sit down with Mario Testino for his hypothetical last meal. That's all in the July-August issue of Monocle, on newsstands everywhere now. Or head to monocle.com to become a subscriber.
You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Now, journalistic ethics are an inexact science, especially when working in the field, where reporters are often the recipients of some level of hospitality from people they're writing about. It's usually the workaday courtesies, a cup of coffee, lunch if we're lucky, no one really likes us all that much, and as such, harmless enough. Hackles should start twitching, however, long before the point at which we're offered a 10% stake in a new company being floated by a former CIA gunrunner. This appears not to have happened swiftly enough when the Wall Street Journal's chief foreign affairs correspondent, Jay Solomon, was apparently made such a proposition, and he has now been dismissed by the Wall Street Journal. Well, joining me with more is Ivor Gaber, professor of journalism at the University of Sussex, a regular Monocle 24 contributor. Ivor, looking at the details of this particular case before we look at the generalities, what does Jay Solomon appear to have done wrong?
Well, that's a very good question, Andrew. I think the reports that I've read have trod very carefully, given legal implications, because there is lots of... Is there smoking guns? But anyway, there's lots of circumstantial evidence with hacked emails, which looks like he was actually working for the gentleman you describe, or the company that he set up. But he denies ever having received any money. But I have to say, when there's a, if we're to believe the leaked emails, one of them says, I'm just not exactly quoting verbatim, but good luck, Jay, on your first day selling our product. I paraphrase. It does look a little suspicious, but I don't think he's necessarily committed any legal offence, but certainly in journalistic terms, he had a go.
Yeah, I have to say I'm kind of insulted myself, frankly, that in the many weeks, months I have logged in reporting from more than 80 countries, I've never been offered anything quite so exciting or lucrative sounding. But if you are... I guess what we're trying to figure out is where the boundary is. If you are abroad working as a reporter and you do run across some sort of commercial opportunity, and let's assume that the commercial opportunity is entirely legitimate, how are you supposed to react?
Well, I think it's fairly straightforward. If you are reporting that area of work, there is a straight conflict of interest. Okay, so Andrew goes reporting in South Africa and somebody says, I've got an ice cream stall, would you man it for a couple of hours and here's 10 rand? That's probably okay. But if you are reporting, let's say, the mining industry and somebody says, would you like a share in this gold mine? I think that's probably not OK. So there are a few grey areas, but this is a pretty substantial, full on guilty malad.
The grey areas, though, do exist. And what also appears to have gone on here Yeah, this could get weird. Let's move this into an entirely hypothetical scenario that obviously if you are a journalist and you are reporting on business in particular and you're reporting on politics as well, then it may well be that you will meet people who other people would like to meet. So are there hard and fast rules for leveraging contacts you've made through journalism into realms outside journalism?
Well, the ultimate criterion that I tell my students is to thine own self be true, or to put it more crudely, if somebody found out, would you feel very bad about it? Would your job be at risk? It's not quite, you know, you can cheat as long as you don't get found out. But there's an element of how would it feel if it went public. But you do raise an interesting point, because reporters who report business and finance will often have intelligence information, inside information even, which might lead them to speculate, to buy some of the shares in the company they hear about. Now, that is forbidden. Journalists in the UK have been dismissed for what's called insider trading. So we're pretty, I mean, I think, okay, there's a few grey areas, and accepting a cup of tea or even a lunch is fine, but it's pretty clear, you know in yourself when you've crossed the line.
Is there, though, something in the parable of the frog in the slowly heating pan? You'll be familiar with this scenario. The idea is, if you drop a frog into a pan of water that's boiling, the frog will leap out again. But if the frog is in the water that becomes gradually warmer, the frog tends not to notice until it's too late. And Jay Solomon's statement on the subject has said that I entered into a world which I didn't understand, this idea being that it was a gradual accretion before he realised that the water had become on the warm side.
Well, you raise a good point, because that does tend to happen in not necessarily exactly the same world, but the world of intelligence. A journalist, and I have done this myself, when you go into a foreign country, particularly a hostile zone, you might go to your embassy or a friendly embassy and get a briefing. And the quid pro quo is, if you come back from the front line, you might tell your briefer what you found. It's a start of a slippery slope where you end up being an agent of interest or even a full-time spy. So, yeah, frogs do get boiled and they don't even realise the water's getting hot.
And looking at how the Wall Street Journal have handled this, was there any other option beyond sacking him, do you think?
Well, no, particularly because this wasn't revealed by themselves, but this was a great exclusive, a scoop, as we used to say, from AP, the press agency. I don't know whether the Wall Street Journal knew this was going on, but once AP released it to the world, they had, in my view, they had absolutely no choice.
And looking ahead, if you are Jay Solomon or you are a reporter caught in a similar thing, are you done for then as a reporter? Would any other, or should, I mean, you know, clearly he's a very good journalist and a very experienced journalist. Does something like this define a journalist if they are caught up in something like this?
I think in general it does. I'm trying to think of a case of a reporter, there's been a number in the US involving the New York Times, the Washington Post, who got done for unethical behaviour, not this sort of behaviour, and haven't come back. In general, I think that probably does for his journalistic career, but he's probably got a pretty lucrative career somewhere in PR for the arms trade.
Ivor Gaber, Professor of Journalism at the University of Sussex, thanks for joining us. You're listening to The Daily. You're listening to The Daily. Now, the team behind The Urbanist has been busy reporting from ReSite, a two-day conference aimed at tackling some of the biggest challenges for modern cities, bringing over 700 experts, policymakers and urban thinkers to the Forum Karlín in Prague. Our editor Andrew Tuck took advantage of one of the coffee breaks to speak with Jean-Louis Misica, who's the deputy mayor of Paris. Jean-Louis is in charge of town planning, architecture, economic development and competitiveness in the French capital. Here he tells Andrew about how Paris has had to adapt following terror incidents similar to the ones not merely in Paris, but also Nice and London.
First of all, in Paris, and I think that it will be the same in London, we have a lot of policemen and military people walking with guns and so on. So the presence of the security forces has to be at a higher level if we want to discourage terrorism. Another example is all the system of control at the entrance of theaters or stadium. So you have a long queue, long files of people waiting for entrance, and it's a new vulnerability to have these people. This is why, for example, we have decided to build glass wall around the Tour Eiffel in order to protect the tourists And of course, it will change the look of the Eiffel Tower. So we are very aware of that all this new terrorist threat and environment change the look of the city. For example, when we have decided to make the Champs-Élysées open to the pedestrians one Sunday per month, we had a long conversation with the Préfecture de Police, with the police officers, in order to see how to protect people from vehicles like in London or in Nice. And we know of new kind of, I don't know the word or in English, blocks, very strong blocks, which protect all the streets of the Champs-Élysées. And so you see that the street design, the public space design, is of course transforming a little bit, not for the best, but this is the constraint of security. I don't know how long this terrorist street will last. Some people say 15 years, 20 years, we don't know. But of course, the way we are thinking, for example, the new theaters or the new stadium, we put security first. On the other side, the fire incident, I think, is typical of the problems of London. I think that we don't have towers like that in Paris, and the rules of security, I think, are different. I don't say stronger because I'm not specialized enough, but I think the rules are different in Paris.
Do you think that fire could have happened in Paris?
I don't know. Of course, a fire could happen in Paris, and we have a lot of buildings which are very vulnerable, what we call immeuble précaire, precarious buildings. All cities have this kind of buildings. For example, New York, what is very interesting is that we use big data in order to make the identification of this kind of buildings, because this kind of buildings have some very specificities. For example, lack of maintenance. For example, rent charges paid late. And New York have done first this kind of analysis, big data analysis, and we try to do the same in order to be able to say this building is at risk. And we can send security forces to check if we are right in our data analysis. Because it's difficult to check all the buildings, so you have to focus on certain kind of buildings, and big data can help.
That was Jean-Louis Missika, Deputy Mayor of Paris, speaking to Monocle's editor Andrew Tuck. You're listening to The Daily. This is the Monocle Daily, live from Studio One at Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Now, the Great Mosque of Al-Nuri in Mosul is far from the first significant building or monument that Islamic State has destroyed or damaged during its rampage across Syria and Iraq. But even by Islamic State standards, yesterday's demolition of the 12th century mosque and its famous leaning minaret seemed a gesture of extraordinary petulance, a final act of pointless vandalism as Iraqi forces closed in on Mosul's old city. I'm joined with more on this by Renard Mansour with the Middle East and North Africa program at Chatham House. Renard, first of all, for those of us who've never been to Mosul, what was the Al-Nuri Mosque like? Give us a sense of how it fit into the city's architecture.
Well, it was clearly the landscape, the skyline of Mosul, if you will. It was very identifiable. As you say, a mosque that's been there for hundreds and hundreds of years, very much part of the city. Not just the fact that it was a religious symbol, but very much a part of the city, a symbol of Mosul, a symbol of a city that doesn't just have Muslims, but also Christians and all the other diverse groups. Everyone recognized this mosque and that minaret as part of the history of their city.
So it was an incredibly important symbol of the city and a way that people identified their city, like, you know, the harbour bridge in my hometown, for example.
Yeah, and it just reminded the people about how historic the civilizations were and how many different civilizations and groups and states and caliphates before that had governed over the city, and how that symbol had been able to withstand so many different ups and downs through the hundreds and hundreds of years.
A symbolism, of course, that Islamic State clearly understood when al-Baghdadi used it as the location to proclaim the caliphate, I think, in 2014 when Islamic State came into Mosul. Does it seem, are you surprised that they've decided to blow it up?
Well, we've been saying for a long time that religion is only instrumentalized by this group, whereas, you know, when it comes to things, what's more important to them could be economic resources or the instrumentalization of religion, meaning that it doesn't mean necessarily that what they're pursuing would be Islamic as such, even though they're using Islamic discourse. To them, the loss is more important. The symbolism of losing the one and only place where Baghdadi gave his speech after announcing the caliphate, having, you know, Iraqi forces, Iraqis regaining that territory would have been such a big symbol of the loss of what the state that they were trying to build, that that was more important to them than any kind of religious repercussions to destroying such an important symbol.
So that's basically what it was. It's Islamic State saying, if we can't have it, neither can you.
Yeah, and I think what their strategy is to try and blame, what they're saying is it's the U.S. airstrikes that hit it down, it's other people's. They won't admit that they blew it themselves. But I think, and it's still a debate, to be honest. I mean, people are saying what happened, people are going to understand what happened. But for now, everyone seems to agree that it was themselves that detonated it from booby traps within.
If it was Islamic State who destroyed it, which does seem by far the most plausible explanation, does it strike you as different from the, you know, extraordinary vandalism we've seen them commit elsewhere, most famously in Palmyra, but all across Syria and Iraq? They, I'm rather thinking of the Taliban's destruction of the Bamiyan Buddhas as well. There was just this attempt to obliterate everything that came before them and their idea of Islam and their idea of a caliphate. Is that congruent with that, or have they blown the Al-Nuri Mosque up just because of the situation they now find themselves in?
I think to some extent the things that they've been blowing up, the things they've been destroying before, they didn't associate with. This they clearly associated with. They made Mosul the center of their sort of caliphate in Iraq, at least, if not wider. This mosque was where their leader gave his only, you know, public kind of sermon. It was clearly very important to them. So destroying something that they've already identified as being so important is a big step, and it shows you the dire situation that they're finding themselves in. It shows you the existential threat and crisis that they themselves are facing. And that's why they won't even admit. I mean, and the other times they would admit they destroyed it. They won't, they're hesitant to admit that what they've done here, because they're worried about what that would mean to the existence of their project.
Iraqi authorities are sounding obviously increasingly confident about Mosul. This has taken a lot longer, I think, than they anticipated, but they're clearly getting there. They're talking about Islamic State being down to a few hundred fighters in the old city and victory being a matter of days or weeks away. If that victory is won and Islamic State is effectively banished from Iraqi territory, how big a deal is that for Iraq?
Well, I think one can say that actually the Islamic State has fell a while ago. They haven't really been a state as such, more like an underground organization. And that's where they're moving towards. Anyone who says that Mosul will always completely be governed by Iraqis without these kind of criminal networks and ISIS underground organizations, anyone who says that would be lying. They're going to exist. They're going to go underground. But this is a huge kind of, it would be a huge symbolic victory for there to be stabilization in Mosul, for there to be moving forward with a new governance in the provincial councils. It would be a big victory. But, you know, and Iraqis are excited. The mood in Iraq right now is very high. Everyone is excited. We're fighting ISIS. However, it's cautious optimism, because if you ask any leader in Iraq, in Mosul, in the north, in the northern province, the Sunni leaders, are the roots that led to this disaster, are the roots that led to the Islamic State, have they been addressed? Nobody would say that the roots have been addressed, meaning that militarily we've beat them, but these guys have been beaten before. It's an organization that's existed since 2003. The Islamic State of Iraq was declared in 2006, if you remember. So ISIS, as an organization, isn't really going anywhere just yet. As a state governing territory, it's taken a setback. Now the big challenge is, how can there be a political settlement to try and address what is the underground organization that will try and kind of maintain some kind of presence in Mosul and other parts?
Nevertheless, though, all those reservations taken on board, after the, well, if we date it back to the invasion in 2003, after that 13 years of ebbing and flowing internal conflict, occasionally erupting into outright civil war in Iraq, would it be important for the country to have some sense of a collective triumph, as you were putting it, a victory that we have won?
Yeah, and it's been a costly victory. Many Iraqis have died, and there are many martyrs to this victory. But as I say, this victory correlates with a public mood in Iraq that's very high. People think the country is going in the right direction at the moment, insofar as they've managed to defeat what was a very scary force that took over a third of their territory. So the mood is high. This is a huge moment for the Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi to be able to kind of bring everyone together. Everyone's willing to come together, but again, we need to be cautious because there's a lot of questions that still aren't being answered, and those questions are more fundamental than a few fighters that took over the city a few years ago.
Renard Mansour from Chatham House, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24. To China now on The Daily, where there remains immense societal pressure for young people to secure a job that will provide lifelong stability. A chef is not therefore considered the ideal career path, but this is starting to change in the big cities where young entrepreneurs are foregoing traditional corporate jobs and striking out on their own in the culinary world. The result has been a much needed boost for Chinese traditional street foods, which are struggling to survive in a rapidly changing and modernizing country. Monocle Shanghai correspondent Justin Bergman meets two entrepreneurs in Shanghai and Beijing who are doing exactly that.
The lights are turned low in Jenny Gao's Shanghai apartment, and candles flicker on the bookshelves. Around the dining room table, her 10 dinner guests are making small talk and sipping craft beers from a Beijing microbrewery.
That's like what it is today.
Just as everyone is getting acquainted, Gao suddenly emerges from the kitchen with the first dishes of the night. Fermented Sichuan pickles and spicy fava beans. Two traditional snacks from her hometown of Chengdu in western China.
Welcome to Fly by Jing Private Kitchen. This is only the second time that I'm doing it. So first time was in February. So thanks for coming. I think I know
the private supper club, inspired by the street food of Chengdu, has been a dream of Gao's since she moved back to China several years ago. Gao was born in Chengdu, but her family left when she was young, and she was brought up mostly in Canada. After graduating from business school, she worked in the tech industry and for an innovation consultancy. But she felt unfulfilled by the corporate world. That's when she made a drastic decision. She quit her job and followed her passion to learn how to make the food from her native Sichuan province, which is famed the world over for its bold use of chilies and the intoxicating, mouth-numbing Sichuan peppercorn. Now Gao has a successful business running her private supper club, organizing pop-up dinners in collaboration with chefs across Asia, and producing a line of artisanal Sichuan sauces.
So it's through like the products and also through these experiences that I'm really hoping to bring people closer into like what Sichuan food means to me. Okay.
Among Chinese millennials, she's hardly alone. More and more young people are breaking with tradition by giving up secure, stable jobs to take a risk on starting their own businesses in the culinary world. And thanks to these new food entrepreneurs, traditional Chinese cuisine, and in particular street food, is being reinterpreted in creative and wholly unexpected ways. Gao's aim is to resurrect the traditional Sichuan recipes and flavors she remembers as a child, but put a new spin on them by incorporating higher quality ingredients.
So, for example, for my sweet water noodles, which is a very famous street snack from Chengdu, it's a chewy, very al dente noodle. And I'm using like imported Italian 00 pasta flour for that because I find it has a lot better of a mouthfeel, a lot better of a bite. And of course you wouldn't find that in Sichuan. And also, you know, I use this organic like white sesame paste that has a much richer depth of flavor, which even though the proportions and the recipes are exactly the same as very traditional versions, it tastes completely different sometimes.
This is her way of paying homage to a style of cooking that's disappearing as Chengdu rapidly gentrifies and culinary traditions are no longer passed down from generation to generation.
I remember it being a treat, and, you know, on the weekends to go with my grandparents or my parents to our neighborhood street snack spot. And the flavors have really changed over time, and this is confirmed by my grandparents, who now they don't eat at those places anymore because they think that the flavor has gone down over time, and also they tend to not trust the vendors anymore. I think a lot of the old school establishments are either shut down or they've changed hands, and they're no longer run by people who have been doing it for decades.
In Beijing, another entrepreneur, Zhang Tianyi, has a similar motivation for opening his own restaurant serving traditional rice noodles from his home in Hunan province.
My hometown Chang'e was the first place in China to cultivate rice and has over 6,500 years of growing rice. To us, rice noodle is something embedded in our soul. So when I started to think about what I was going to sell, rice noodle came to my mind first.
Zhang graduated with a law degree from prestigious Peking University. But rather than follow his classmates to a big law firm, he launched his noodle business instead.
Actually, our first restaurant is operating under Chinese, the biggest law firm. So lots of my classmates, they work in that law firm, and I operate my business under this law firm. Many of them don't understand my choice, especially my parents. They think I should be a lawyer.
Zhang hit a low point about a week after opening, when sales were flat and he was feeling frustrated. To motivate himself, he wrote an essay about his passion for food called Why I'm Selling Rice Noodles with a Master's Degree, and he posted it online. The response was phenomenal. The essay tapped into the anxiety that many young people feel about their lack of career prospects in China and the pressure they're under to make money rather than follow a dream. The essay went viral, getting reposted more than 10 million times. Not all people were supportive of his decision, but he became an online celebrity nonetheless. And now Zhang's business is flourishing, with 10 locations in shopping malls across Beijing and plans for 30 more this year.
When I graduated, I asked myself, does Beijing lack a financial lawyer? The answer was no. But does Beijing lack a good Hunan beef rice noodle restaurant? The answer was yes. I think the value of the business comes from scarcity.
Zhang's business model isn't focused on improving the classic Hunan rice noodle dish, but rather perfecting it. That's why, when he was looking for the perfect recipe, he went back to the source, his hometown of Chang'e.
There are over 30 kinds of herbs in the beef soup. Taking out just one herb will change the taste significantly. I wasn't sure of one or two herbs back then, so I went back to Chang'e to learn. After I ate rice noodles in about 100 shops, I finally found the best one and asked them to teach me. I just wanted to know what the herb was.
And just what that mystery ingredient might be, he's not saying anything more. But it's dedication like this from young entrepreneurs like Zhang Tianyi and Jenny Gao that's helping these traditional foods from their parents' generation live on, even if they don't always have their parents' support. For Monocle in Shanghai and Beijing, I'm Justin Bergman.
For more food and drink stories, of course, tune into The Menu. This week's edition premieres tomorrow at 1900 London time. You can, of course, catch up with that and all our other shows anytime you like on our website. Coming up, the Asian newspapers. Do stay tuned.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage, built on the unique dedication of our people. We bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work, and we know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in weekly to The Bulletin with UBS for all the latest insights and opinions from UBS and experts from around the world.
It's time now to take a look at the Asian newspapers. We're joined once again by John Everard, former UK ambassador to North Korea, author of the North Korea memoir, Only Beautiful, Please. And John, it is in North Korea that we start. This report from the American press, but it's being reported everywhere as people still try to figure out what Donald Trump meant with another one of his gnomic tweets earlier this week. This was the, of course, I appreciate the efforts of President Xi in China to help with North Korea. It's not worked out. At least I know China tried. What does it all mean?
Well, that is the question of the moment. The people have focused on the fact that the sentence in the second sentence of the tweet is in the past tense. At least China tried, implying that that is the end of that approach to North Korea, and we now take another one, which has put the cat amongst the pigeons, rather. People have looked to Trump's aides, associates, staff for explanations. Nothing very much has been forthcoming. And the story that I brought you today is largely drawn on conversations at the Defence and Security Dialogue between the United States and China, where people hoped that Tillerson and Mattis, both of whom attended, would actually shed some light on what Trump said. They pointedly did not. They talked in very general terms about China continuing to work on this, that there being lots of progress on a concerted policy towards North Korea, but with no specifics at all and no real attempt to elucidate what Donald Trump might have meant.
Should we be nervous about that? Wouldn't it be the case that if there were serious things going on, they would be by definition behind the scenes where North Korea is concerned?
Well, yes. With a normal presidency, that would indeed be the case. Donald Trump is entirely capable of tweeting his inmost thoughts to the world before breakfast. And it's quite possible that that is indeed what he's done, that there is a serious policy review underway, perhaps even looking at some really quite difficult options, which people were not supposed to talk about, but which the president himself has announced.
Moving on to the Shanghaiist, and it's a bit of a hardy perennial, this one. This is the Yulin Dog Meat Festival, which is exactly what it sounds like it is, which is obviously, it's less than an international publicity bonanza for China at this point, isn't it?
Nicely put. Yes, it is a very difficult issue for the Chinese government internationally. Yulin, a town in Guangxi, unknown to most of the rest of the world, except for the fact that every June it has a festival of dog meat, where lots of stalls are set up and people eat, well, dog meat, of course. Well, I mean, that of itself you could probably get away with, but it's a pretty violent and brutal affair. The stalls have lots of dog carcasses hanging from them, which tends to annoy dog lovers worldwide. Moreover, the way that the dogs are captured, held and slaughtered, in the immortal words of the animal rights movement, falls well short of international standards. How much detail do you want? It really is quite unpleasant.
But nonetheless, there is there's kind of a morally bracing question in this for those of us who are non-vegetarian such as myself. And one of the, one person interviewed for this piece in the Shanghaiist does actually make the, on the face of it, perfectly reasonable philosophical point that if this was a chicken-eating festival, literally nobody would care.
Yes, it's a very fair point. And I think that the fact that they're eating dogs rather than chickens is of itself not objectionable. Once you accept the fact that you eat an animal, then why not a dog rather than a chicken or indeed a cow? The animal rights movement gets much more concerned not about the fact that these are dogs, but about the way that they are being treated. There is immense cruelty in the trade. Curiously, dog meat, of course, eaten not just in China, but in various other Asian countries, notably in Korea too. The trade generally seems to be just nasty and cruel. In South Korea, for example, if you eat beef, you can be fairly sure that that cow has been raised and slaughtered in ways that would probably just about pass an RSPCA inspection in the UK. If you eat dog, you can be pretty sure that dog has been brutalized and beaten to death in a rather nasty way. The whole industry is uncontrolled.
Moving along to the Indian Express, this is following up a story that we've been looking at once or twice this week, and this was the arrest it's really not funny except to the extent that it is, of 15 Muslim men who were apparently overheard cheering on Pakistan in last week's Champions Trophy cricket final. Pakistan, of course, beat India. India were shockingly bad. I mean, really extraordinarily bad. And I speak as somebody who couldn't normally care less about one-day cricket, but it was a morbidly compelling spectacle watching that distinguished top order fall in a heap like that. But is all well that ends well here? Madhya Pradesh police are dropping sedition charges. Was it just because they realised that the entire world had started laughing at them?
I think there was quite a large element of that, yes. Is all well that ends well? The 15 young men are not quite out of the woods yet, because the police have decided to drop the sedition charges and go instead for charges of disturbing communal harmony, which is a much lesser offence, but nevertheless an offence. And they're also maintaining conspiracy charges. Conspiracy to what, for heaven's sake? But the police say they dropped...
That's a fair question.
Yeah. The police say they dropped the sedition charges because they were hard to prove, which is a masterly understatement. I mean, all these people seem to have done is to jump up and down and shout sort of pro-Pakistani slogans at cricket matches. What one does, for heaven's sake? It's a slap on the wrist, perhaps. But sedition, one of the fiercest laws in India, was way, way over the top.
Now, I'm going to add that to my list of treasured euphemisms. Police describing charges as hard to prove. Is it the police describing charges as absolute nonsense?
Yes.
And we know it. But there is a wider story here, of course, which is that it does just illustrate the extraordinary tensions that do still exist at a day-to-day level between India and Pakistan. I mean, you know, as an Australian, I am not unfamiliar with great international sporting rivalries, but really the worst that would happen to me if I cheered on Australia among Englishmen in a pub here during a cricket match is, I might get a slap on the head. I'm not going to be charged by police.
Yeah, you can be pretty sure you're not going to get charged by police. You're right. Great rivalries between India and Pakistan, more immediately in this case, between different communities in Madhya Pradesh. It's looking very much as if the reason the police jumped on these 15 unfortunate individuals was that certain quite hardline Hindus came up to the police and made formal complaints against them, and the police felt obliged to act. Why on earth they preferred sedition charges rather than minor offence charges, we may never find out. But yes, as you say, an illustration of these rivalries.
Or why the police didn't just tell the complainants, look, it's a cricket match, get over it.
Well, it depends on the claimant's word, doesn't it?
Indeed it does. Moving along finally to Dunya News. Yes, one straight out of the what could possibly go wrong files. Somebody has launched a children's toy craze it is what it says it is, the toothpick crossbow.
Yes, indeed. A tiny crossbow about the length of an adult finger, which is designed to fire, as the name suggests, a toothpick. The trouble is that these crossbows are rather good at what they're made to do, and they can fire a toothpick at some considerable velocity, fast enough to penetrate cardboard, and if you're clever with the things, even a soda can. Evidently, somebody's been practicing with all kinds of interesting targets. The blurb on them says they're also pretty good against cockroaches, so cockroach sniping could be the new sport. The problem is that, of course, kids are indiscriminate in the way they will shoot these things, and that a lot of kids have discovered that they'll fire not just cocktail sticks, but needles and other metal objects, which will pierce a lot more than a sheet of cardboard. You have to be very careful. Three Chinese cities have already banned these. Big calls for them to be banned nationwide.
John Everard, thanks as always for joining us. You're listening to The Daily. Finally tonight on The Daily, it is more than 20 years since the end of the civil war in Bosnia-Herzegovina. The country remains divided, however, not least because of laws and conventions specifically intended to maintain the divisions, even among Bosnians who weren't even alive when the last shots were fired. However, one group of Bosnian secondary students have not only protested against the ethnic segregation of the schools in their district, they've won, and they intend to continue their campaign. I'm joined with more on this by Samir Beharic, an activist and former student of the school in question. Samir, first of all, explain how the segregation of education has worked in Bosnia. How different is it, and how is it decided who is educated in what way?
Hello and good evening. First of all, thank you very much for having me in your program, and thank you for the interest. in this very serious matter that Bosnia-Herzegovina is facing since the Serb aggression that ended in 1995. Well, first of all, I was a student who attended a ethnically segregated primary school in central Bosnian city of Jajce, where I am an ethnic Bosniak, meaning Muslim. Currently in Bosnia, for those who do not know, we have three ethnic groups, Bosniaks, Bosnian Croats, and Bosnian Serbs, meaning Muslims, Catholics, and Orthodox people who live together. They have coexisted together for centuries in Bosnia-Herzegovina. And in central Bosnian city of Jajce, when I was born and raised, primary schools operate in a way where children from different ethnic / religious backgrounds attend the same building as a school, but attend classes in physically separate classrooms.
How different is what you're taught? As you said, you're a Bosniak, so if you were being taught, I guess, especially about recent history, how different would be what was taught to a Serbian or Croat kid?
Well, first of all, recent history is not taught at all. That is one of the most critical problems. The history narratives are taught differently. That's one of the biggest problems. The historic narratives that are old 500 years are still interpreted in different ways, depending on which side is interpreting them. It's not only history, it's the cultural education, it's the literature that's being taught to children. And that is the framework under which children are being taught into a future nationalistic party voters. And that is a machine that raises young nationalists into students who will continue dividing already divided, basically, Bosnian society. And now a group of students, secondary school students, has opposed the idea that politicians divide them in secondary schools.
So tell me about this campaign that these kids from Jajce have mounted. What does it tell us about upcoming generations? Do they regard those divisions as ancient history?
Absolutely. So the new generations who are coming are basically aware of the fact that nationalism is chasing away young Bosnians from Bosnia-Herzegovina. For your information, Bosnia-Herzegovina has 64% youth unemployment rate, according to World Bank. Bosnia-Herzegovina has one of the highest brain drain rates in the world. Young Bosnians are leaving as we speak. According to some local researchers, it is like 80,000 young people have left the country during the last 2 years. It is 110 people a day. It is 4.6 people in average every hour. And this is something that bad policies are making to young Bosnians, nationalist policies, and young upcoming generations who are now 14 to 18, 20, are very much aware of that, and they want to take the course of their future into their own hands.
So can you see this cause gaining traction? These kids who've succeeded in desegregating their own school have said they want to continue the campaign throughout their particular canton around Jajce, but can you imagine this being popular with kids that age all across Bosnia, by which I mean in Republika Srpska as well?
Well, I do sincerely think this plan is a very serious plan. It gained traction. It gained the support from, it got the support from the international community, from the OECD, foreign embassies, who also helped in this process of integrating schools. At the moment in Bosnia-Herzegovina, we have 54 schools who are operating until, according to this segregation system, it is a so-called two schools under one roof, where you have literally two schools in one school building. And I do think that in central Bosnian canton, this thing could be solved with help of politicians. This is not so hard to solve. The biggest problem is a lack of political will, lack of the will of nationalistic politicians who are gaining and getting their nationalistic voters directly from these schools. So until we dismantle nationalistic narratives in Bosnia-Herzegovina. We are even closer to dismantle the two schools under one roof and 21st century apartheid.
Samir Baharic, thank you for joining us. That is it for today's edition of The Daily. It was produced by Daniel Giacopelli. The researchers were Jolene Goffan and Fia Metachazana. Our studio manager, Antonio Fernandez. The Globalist is here 8 hours from now. The Daily is back at the same time tomorrow. I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.